Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, North and South Carolina get another hurricane soaking, this time from Michael, but we're spared the brunt of the storm. Former South Carolina governor and ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, resigns. But why? A busy week at City Council as they decide on the sale of land set aside for affordable housing and disagree over a cleaning contract with a company some believe is not offering employees a living wage. Bus drivers are getting a raise in an effort to fill vacancies, and former Charlotte Mayor and Secretary of Transportation Anthony Fox gets a new job featuring some heavy lifting. Did you get that? Thank you very much. Our roundtable of reporters is ready to detail those stories and others. Those reporters include David Borax with WFAU.
Hello, Mike.
Hi, Mary C. Curtis is here. She's a columnist for RollCall.com and a contributor to WCCB-TV, among others. Hello.
Hello.
Kirsten Garris is government reporter for Spectrum News. Hi to you.
Good morning.
And Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer for the Charlotte Business Journal, is back again. Welcome.
Thank you, Mike. Good morning.
We're all on the radio. We're also on Facebook Live. Hurricane Michael smashed into the Florida panhandle, of course, rampaged through Georgia on its way to rain-soaked North and South Carolina. Governor Cooper declared a state of emergency for more than half the counties in the state even before this monster storm hit Florida.
The last thing people cleaning up from Florence need right now is more wind and rain. But this storm is coming. And we will be ready for it.
So Michael's wind and rain impacted the Carolinas, but because it was a fast-moving storm, we were really spared the worst. How did the two Carolinas fare in this storm?
Well, a lot of power outages. I know as of last night, we were recording at least 50,000 outages in Mecklenburg County and some of the nearby areas. And school was closed yesterday and today because there were outages that are leaving some schools without power. So obviously you can't have kids.
Some like 36 schools.
Mm-hmm.
Or
32 schools. And the 19th were completely, like, they still haven't restored power. So
parents took that well, though. They were very calm about it.
Yeah, I think the kids really took that really well. I can tell they were really, you know.
I noticed that I drove through Dilworth to get here yesterday, and my regular route was just fine. This morning I couldn't do it because there were trees down all across the roads in Dilworth.
I actually came up Providence Road from South Charlotte right at the peak of the storm yesterday, and there was so much wind, and the trees were bending over. There was branches in the street, and shortly after that, we started having power outages and all that. You know, you were asking about this one compared to Florence, and I think there was one comparison that I saw was Medic put out statistics about the number of calls yesterday. 73 calls for trees or down power lines, 67 for wrecks with injuries, and they said this was significantly more than Florence. So
really?
I think in that respect, we got hit a little harder this time.
But the flooding wasn't as bad as Florence, correct?
That's right.
Well, at least out here in Boone, we had people saying they felt like the flooding was worse.
And they still were coming in, and there were a lot of traffic lights that were out, mm-hmm. and you had the police directing traffic, so there was a lot of backups, and a big tree fell over Queens Road West, and so it did a lot more damage than you would have thought.
And I think when the school system sent their cancellation out, there were about 82,000 people without power in Charlotte at that time, half a million, I think, across the state, so pretty significant.
There was a thing in the paper, and I should have written it down, but I didn't, that the schools, since they started school on August 27th, they've only had a couple of full weeks.
I can tell you as a parent, my daughter told me last night, my ninth grader said that last week was their first full week.
Oh, wow.
Really?
Yeah.
So when are the makeup days?
Yeah, I know. Well, and you know, the previous cancellations they said would not need to be made up, but I really wonder about these two.
Yeah. A lot of homeschooling.
Well, I hope they enjoy their Thanksgiving at school.
Yeah, or some Saturday school. Yes. Who knows? We'll see.
So prior to Michael's arrival, city arborist Tim Porter warned that the 35-mile-per-hour winds combined with the saturated ground those trees were sitting on could cause significant damage. Would you say that we had significant tree fall yesterday, or do you know?
I think we had areas like Myers Park, South Charlotte have a lot of big trees that usually come up. So I think the areas that usually deal with trees falling had that happen. The areas that usually flood when it rains had that happen. I think Charlotte as a whole was pretty much spared because, again, it moved so quickly. It was like raining, and then yesterday afternoon it was like, oh, the sun's here. You know, it happened pretty quickly.
I do think there was about an hour and a half there where the winds were so heavy that I think it met the arborist's prediction there in that respect. We did have a lot of power outages related to it. You know, there was a number of cases where trees fell on people's vehicles. There was one pretty bad one there near Queen's University yesterday afternoon about 1 o'clock where one person had life-threatening injuries, the other one was seriously hurt. And so I think we did see that.
In North Carolina, I do believe there was a death.
Iredell County.
But those poor folks in the panhandle of Florida and South Georgia, I just can't imagine what life's going to be like for them. What happened? I was thinking about this morning in the shower. What happens if you lose everything? I mean, you still have a mortgage on the house that doesn't exist. You still have a car that a payment on the car that the storm washed away or ruined or a tree fell on it. You have no job because your business is gone. What do you do?
Yeah,
how do you live?
And the other thing is, Mike,
how do you recover?
You not only all of those things, and then you get into the bureaucratic tangle of trying to get insurance to help you, checking the policies. Yeah, it's going to be years. I know it's cliche.
Find the policies first, right?
Yeah, there was a report today from an NBC reporter who was standing in the middle of a building that had literally just been cratered, and he described it as it looked like it had been in a blender, and it absolutely did. You couldn't even tell that it had been a structure.
And they weren't really expecting that because that magnitude of storm had not hit that area. And even so, they were saying Category 3, and when it hit, it was close to a 5. And some folks who had stayed in, I hear they were saying because some people hadn't turned off the gas, there were also fires, so it was a lot of damage.
They put these reporters out in these storms, and they did it again for this Category 4, almost a Category 5, and Ginger Z, who's a meteorologist for ABC, they actually pulled her off the balcony of this hotel room as the storm was crashing through. And put her inside, and as she was doing a stand-up in front of the window, a house floated by. And you could see how shaken she was by that, because these people are – I mean, I don't care if you're inside a building or not. Those buildings are going to go like that. Well, I mean, she was visibly shaken.
And reading the stories, Mike, the accounts of the hospitals down there, and they were having to turn people away, and meanwhile – they're begging the nurses and doctors to stick around to try and help evacuate. It is just a horrible mess.
Good luck to them. Our thoughts are with them. Areas of this state, of course, are still recovering from Hurricane Florence, and North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper used the opportunity Michael provided to say it was time for the state to step up and do its job to fund recovery.
An unprecedented storm requires an unprecedented response. When you've had 2 500-year floods within 2 years, like we've had in North Carolina, rebuilding smarter and stronger isn't just an idea. It's an obligation.
And so he called for $1.5 billion in state funding for Hurricane Florence recovery efforts. So preliminary estimates of damage, though, come in at $13 billion. The governor said he will ask the General Assembly for a down payment when they come back into session of $750 million. Is it likely that he will get that much money or even get enough to come close to the $1.5 billion he says he needs?
The legislators have, at least from what I've seen, have not been real clear on what they're going. They've said, we're going to help. We know we need to help. But
it's an election year, you know.
Yes. And I think not only that, Mike, I think they know.
I think
but they have not. I haven't seen a lot of specific counter offers, if you will, to the governor's request.
I have not either. And I suspect that the debate here will not be over the amount of money that they give, but over who gets credit for it.
Well, I think that's probably right. It's interesting, you know, there's, what, the $2 billion in the rainy day fund?
Yeah.
And this certainly has been a streak of rainy days.
Well, that'll dry up that fund.
Yes, that will dry up that fund. And I think about half of what Cooper is asking for would come from the rainy day fund, and then you have some other monies. So what I'm curious about is whether there is quibbling about how much to use out of the rainy day fund.
Well, speaking of who gets credit for it, Kirsten, Spectrum News, along with SurveyUSA, conducted an exclusive poll to gauge voter opinions on how Hurricane Florence preparation and recovery efforts were handled, and the results were?
Well, a lot of people feel like North Carolina did pretty well. We asked two major questions. One of them, if you could give a letter grade for how the state handled it, and 41% said a B, 34% said an A. So, you know, we're not doing too bad. 15% said a C. So, I mean, for the most part, we're like a B-plus student here for how we handled it. And if you think about it, there was a lot of warning. Since Florence was such a slow-moving storm,
right,
you saw Governor Cooper at least several times a day warning people to leave if you can, you know, get out the way. When it came to who's gets the credit, the governor actually got the highest score. 30% of our you know, folks who respond to our poll said he gets the credit for kind of, again, leading this charge of get out the way. And we did. I mean, we saw Governor Cooper several times trying to get this message
That'll
out.
Go over big on Jones Street.
Yeah, they'll love that one. You know, there was an Elon poll this week, too. 87% approval for Governor Cooper's response. And I think for the president, it was about 57 or 58%. Governor Cooper has been out and about, and voters apparently are paying attention.
First responders in the Spectrum poll came in second to the governor at 27%, local governments 14%, utility companies 7%, the legislature 2%. But in fairness to the legislature, it's not their job to do this. It is the governor's job, Mary.
Yeah, I think it's always interesting now that climate and weather, it's always political. How do you respond? But now it's political because the issues of climate change and environmental regulations and where to develop and whether to redevelop, that's so political as well. And it's interesting that people and voters are really paying much more attention to that when these storms hit, these 500-year storms hit every other year.
I was very interested in that Elon poll because it ticked off a number of environmental issues that we've looked at over the long term, but in the lens of looking at these big storms. And 76% of those who responded to that poll said that they think we should restrict development in flood-prone areas. This goes to what Governor Cooper was saying about building smarter after these storms. You know, I'm a little bit skeptical about our ability to do a plan that actually holds together over time where we actually do that and buy out some of these property owners whose property is in low-lying areas. But they also ask questions about, for example, coal ash. They think there should be increased regulation for coal ash. 72% favored that. And this was one of my favorites. 62% said they think that climate change research should be allowed to be used in local planning. And this goes back to 2012.
That. Yes. The legislature said, no, you can't use that in planning. Did that stand? Is that still in place?
I think what they said, though, wasn't there a long-term study, and they just shortened the projections is what they did.
So, in 2011, the Coastal Research Commission put out a study, and they looked out 100 years, and they had some what looked like dire predictions, although maybe after these storms, maybe not so dire, but about how difficult things will be. And they said the legislature didn't like that, and they said, let's just look out 30 years. So then the following year, after this study came out and they rejected its findings, they passed a law that said local governments cannot use climate research making local ordinances. And that I don't know how enforceable that is. I mean, Charlotte is trying to do some things right now that may or may not go afoul of
that. So more than half of the voters think we should be able to use it for planning purposes, and 80% of those surveys said that climate change is very or somewhat likely to negatively impact the coastal communities here in the next 50 years. This is the same week that the UN came out with a finding that we have until 2040 before the effects of climate change are irreversible. So is public opinion changing on that? Is the public ahead of politicians, and is that likely to have any impact?
One thing about that poll, the number was actually up from last year in that poll asking the question about climate change and how much it will affect go ahead.
One thing I was going to say that was interesting, speaking to Jason Husser, who's the head of that Elon poll, he said, you know, that it seems in particular Republican opinions are shifting. But at the same time, I was asking particularly about the business impact when you talk about hog farms, when you talk about coal ash, those kinds of things. He said, yes, opinion is shifting. But when you get to the details, then it's going to get much more difficult to actually pass new restrictions and limits.
Wait till the insurance companies get involved in all this. This has got to stop at some place. They can't afford this going on year after year.
Well, it's such a national issue now, too.
We have to stop. We'll come back with more on that and all Nikki Haley and Anthony Fox and the City Council as well. Stay with us. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. David Borax is here from our newsroom. Mary C. Curtis from RollCall.com and WCCB-TV. Kirsten Garris from Spectrum News and Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal. We were talking about all these 500-year floods and storms that come every 20 minutes now, all of a sudden, and the impact of that on changing public opinion and the public being, it seems, apparently, ahead of politicians, Mary.
It's true. You see, nationally, our country under President Trump has pulled out of the Paris Accords. You see other countries like France taking the lead, and you see EPA regulations being gutted or pulled back, at least, in the Environmental Protection Agency.
And the president wants to burn more coal.
Yes, and, you know, which is very popular in West Virginia. So we see while the public and the world, in a way, is going one place, that our politicians are actually pulling back on this.
It's also interesting in North Carolina, because at the state level, you've had a lot of loosening of environmental regulations, and then from a city perspective, as several people said, there is an effort to go, obviously, all in, if you will, on environmental friendliness in terms of policy.
Well, a lot of states have taken the lead on it. You look at California, and they've sort of gone their own way. So it's happening more and more than states and cities are making their own deals.
So the governor, and I think you mentioned this, David, the governor wants $180 million to buy houses and move people out of flood-prone areas, according to that Elon poll that we've been talking about. 76% of those polled believe real estate development in those areas should be restricted. This kind of goes in the face of what the General Assembly has decided, because the reasons for their not wanting to have climate change figured into planning is because they don't want to depress real estate values.
Well, and the chair of the Coastal Resources Commission is a real estate developer. So,
what do you know?
So I do think that the in fact, he told me in an interview 2 years ago that the reason they wanted to shift back to a 30-year timeline was, nobody looks out 100 years. 30 years is what we look at in business, is what he said. And that's where they're coming from.
That's how long the loans are.
That's right. That's a mortgage, and that's what they're looking at.
That, too, is a coincidence, Mike.
Oh, how about that? Okay, well, we've done this in Charlotte. I mean, the city has bought houses, or the county, one of the two, bought houses along the Greenway, the Sugar Creek Greenway, because it was a flood-prone area. Which kind of gives you a little flood plane.
Definition of insanity, right?
Yeah, keep going back to the same things over and over again. Okay. In an announcement that surprised even the White House staff this week, Nikki Haley, former governor of South Carolina, resigned as ambassador to the United Nations.
She's done a fantastic job, and we've done a fantastic job together. We've solved a lot of problems, and we're in the process of solving a lot of problems. We're all happy for you in one way, but we hate to lose. Hopefully you'll be coming back at some point, but you won't.
So she was one of the last remaining key cabinet members or original key cabinet members, and the one that seemed to get along best with the president. And Haley was quick to point to the accomplishment she believes the Trump administration has made on the world stage.
Look at what has happened in 2 years with the United States on foreign policy. Now the United States is respected. Countries may not like what we do, but they respect what we do.
Is that true?
Well, remember that the president just went before the UN and they laughed at him.
Yeah. Do they respect him? Do they respect us? I think that's on the wane.
Does she believe that, or is she saying that because she's sitting next to Donald Trump in the Oval Office and she has political ambitions?
Well, she's been very politically astute in having her own political base, where she is agreeing with Trump in many ways, but she also wants to be sure that people know that she is an independent politician. And her timing is impeccable. You know, she didn't get fired by tweet, which is so she's ahead of the game. But she is, as of now, the most popular person across political spectrums in the Trump administration.
So why resign? Get out while the getting's good, while you still have that reputation?
Well, it's after the controversy surrounding Brett Kavanaugh, before the midterms. Say if the Republicans take a hit in the midterms, she will be free of that. She was very careful to say she is not running for anything in 2020 because a lot of the president's allies were a little bit worried.
Here's exactly what she said about that.
For all of you that are going to ask about 2020, no, I am not running for 2020. I can promise you what I'll be doing is campaigning for this one. So I look forward to supporting the president in the next election.
So that, of course, does not preclude her running on the ticket with the president. I don't know if
that's true, too.
That's a good point.
And she is one of the few women and persons of color or minorities
And from an immigrant family.
Yeah,
she solves a lot of problems.
And she has burnished her foreign policy credentials. Look at her resume now. She has been the governor, the administrator of a state, and she has foreign policy credentials. So folks are saying, keep an eye on Nikki Haley.
By the way, there is one safe prediction we can make about Nikki Haley. She will be on that stage at Spectrum Center in 2020 making a primetime speech. There's no doubt about that.
And here's the other thing. With the conventions here in Charlotte, and if you've been thinking about how do I solve my whatever problems I may have as if I'm Mr. Trump, maybe Nikki Haley is a good choice for VP. Why not put the convention in her backyard?
Yeah,
Mike Pence wants to talk to you right now.
Yeah. I think that's not going to happen without a fight.
And she has a little bit of an ethics problem too. She's getting out, but she says she and her husband took some plane trips from business folks, but she said that they were personal friends. Mm-hmm. So she won't run afoul of ethics on that. Yeah. But yes, Nikki Haley. You've seen in her whole career that she's made a lot of great allies and that she hasn't made a lot of enemies, but people are looking at her.
She is very good at threading the needle somehow. I mean, when you look, as we just outlined, all the people who have been through the Trump administration and usually leave in a rancorous situation. I mean, not only is she leaving with the president's endorsement, remember, she was able to push back on the president in several instances.
Yes, Russia.
Right, without being, just sort of thrown out the door. So it's impressive. That is diplomacy. I don't know how she does as a U.N. ambassador, but in terms of being in that White House,
very diplomatic.
She's very
and
diplomatic.
She also said that the women who accused the president deserve to be heard, which is very interesting. So as a woman, public official, she was able to push back with him on that.
David.
I just want to flesh out something that you just mentioned, Mary, about the ethics complaints. Her resignation came a day after this organization in Washington called Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington called for an investigation of these flights that she had taken, which were from business people in South Carolina. And their allegation was that she didn't provide enough information to demonstrate that these were appropriate flights to take. And so, I don't think we can directly tie the two, but I wonder if, she's been thinking about resigning for a while. I think she was already done there and had some run-ins with the president. And I think with this rising, her announcement actually effectively killed the headlines on that thing.
Well,
and,
we also
haven't heard any more about it.
We also know this, David. She will not say that she was confused if there's any issue about the flight. So
it
she doesn't get confused.
She wrote an op-ed just to make sure that people, that she was not the person that wrote the anonymous.
That's right.
Criticizing it. But in that, she also mentioned that she wasn't going to run and that she's disagreed with the president.
Yes.
So that was looked on as, folks saying, okay, a savvy political
move. Everyone expects her to be on the national stage again some way, somehow.
Exactly. And there's always 2024.
And her exit timing was good because she was in there the day before Kanye West.
That's another story.
And she didn't curse. She didn't curse like Kanye did.
She did not leave any headlines.
Yeah.
Okay. So former Charlotte mayor and former U.S. Secretary of Transportation, Anthony Fox, is sticking with transportation in his post-government life. He's taking a job as the chief policy officer and senior advisor to the president and CEO of Lyft. In an article he wrote about this move, he says, I see a future in which we get places safer, faster, smarter, cleaner, and more connected to opportunity. And he references what he calls a transformation underway across the world as people flock to cities, which we have talked about on this program, where he believes Lyft is a viable means of transportation, negating the need for a car. Uber would agree with that. So any comments about that?
Well, I think private sector pay is a wonderful thing, isn't it? So, I think that Anthony Fox is clear, and a lot of people thought he would do this. He is going into the private sector. He had already taken a job, by the way, in December with related companies that was doing private development of infrastructure. He's still going to advise them, but now he's going to Lyft. Look, he has the credentials and the resume, and so he's going into
the
private sector. And the connections. Yeah. And this is a typical path for someone who's been in a cabinet position.
And this is what you would call a government relations kind of position. We call it a lobbyist here in the regular world. And this is a sign, I think, of the maturing of the ride-sharing industry. This is an industry that kind of popped up without going in and applying for any permits or anything. They just stormed in and started doing what they do, and it has definitely changed the landscape. Well, but they've run afoul of local governments in a lot of places. They've had Governments push back and say, you can't do this. And so they are in a lot of fights almost everywhere about how do we do this? What permits do we need? You know, is there any more regulation that's needed? There have been all those discussions about the safety of taking one of these and background checks of drivers. And so they need somebody in a high place who can push for policies that are friendly to Lyft and also for.
So his job choice between Lyft and Bird scooters, is that what
you're Well done.
Exactly. Okay. He scooted over to Lyft. Just, you know. but it is interesting
on
to
a
have.
Line bike.
On a line
bike.
Nobody walks.
Walking is overrated. It's That's cool. So 2017. But no, I think it's interesting that you have someone who is a charlatan, and this is also a place where Lyft is making a really big footprint. I guess probably it's the wrong word to use. But I guess
tire print.
There yes. we go. Because you know, Lyft sees Charlotte as a place where they can try some of these models. I mean, they launched a ditch your car campaign last month, and that's something they're only doing in a few select cities. So they have someone who was a cabinet, you know, a member of a presidential cabinet, also from Charlotte, and really, I mean. Anthony Fox brought different kinds of transportation to this area. So it's telling that he's going to a company like this versus Uber. I don't really know if they have someone of that caliber on their side.
By the way, he'll be here next week. He's speaking at the Chamber's Transportation Summit. So
you know, we'll take a lift there, too, as well.
And he's another person, another politician to watch. You know, he was the mayor of Charlotte, presided over the convention in 2012. And pretty soon he was in the U.S. cabinet. And I think so. We were just talking before about Nikki Haley, a politician with a future that you expect to see him again.
You know who needs help? Yellow cab. City Council had a busy meeting on Monday night. They approved a series of land deals to help meet the city's affordable housing goals. Five measures passed with a single vote. What did they decide to do? You're the government reporter here.
Yes. Well, what's interesting is about three of those projects are basically properties that they're going to turn into single family homes, and they're trying to promote affordable home ownership, which is something new because we all know it's hard to buy a home these days. And so this is something they're trying to do is help folks who may not be able to afford a home to buy one. And what they're going to do with these properties, they're going to have a 15-year deed affordability. So that means for 15 years, these houses will have to stay affordable. So even if I live in it for 5 years, it will be sold to someone else who
deed,
also
deed restrictions.
Exactly. Who fits that same description? So it's doing their best to keep this, try to grow equity in different ways. And I know when I've talked with Pamela Weidman, she's the head of Neighborhood and Housing Services. She says they have to tackle affordable housing in various ways. There's no silver bullet to fix this issue. It's how do we find different ways using city-owned land to turn that into opportunities for other people.
So they're selling 1.4 acres on Spencer Street. On which they will put 59 townhomes, 10% of which will be affordable. That's 5.9 houses.
I don't want the 0.9. I want
exactly.
The
can we add that to mine?
Sorry, no steps.
A quarter acre of Parkwood and the Plaza, where 1 in 5, 20% of the units will be affordable. A third of an acre on Matheson, where 1 of 3 new single-family homes would be affordable. You add these all together, and you get 7 to 8 affordable home units nestled among market-rate housing. The need, however, is 24,000 units.
I was hoping you had that number, yes.
For people making less than 50% of the area's median income of $37,000. And I asked Mayor Lyles yesterday when she was on this program, because 7 or 8 units is almost nothing. I mean, it's infinitesimal. She said, well, you have to make a start, and this is a start. And she seemed pretty perturbed by my remark. But in truth, the city has very few buttons that it can push to make this happen. And she is pushing the ones that she has. So Councilman Justin Harlow said that it's a tool in their box that they don't utilize enough. The city owns more land. Are we going to see more projects?
We should absolutely be seeing more. And there was more to the things that were passed on Monday. There was also a deal to give Habitat for Humanity some land over by the airport, which would result in 47 single-family affordable homes. So let's add that to the total from Monday night's meeting. So that gets us up to about 55. 50. And then there was the
I remind you of the 24,000.
Yes.
And then there was
a start. It's a start.
There was the agreement to buy
23,946. Okay.
There you go.
And then there was the agreement to buy the former Double Oak School off Statesville Avenue for $3 million from CMS. And there's no project slated for that. They're going to be looking at that. But what Pamela Weidman and the mayor are talking about is this is another way that we can look at trying to make this happen. You know, the city is not going to go out and build these 24,000 units. They need to figure out ways to make them happen. And one way is by making the land available. And trying to stick to the plan of chipping away at this over time.
Well, one of the important things, we've talked about this a few times, is the effort by the Foundation for the Carolinas and how they have pulled in the private sector. Now, the question again, Mike, when you have that 24,000 number is, okay, how committed are they? Wells Fargo and some developers have gotten involved. But when you're talking about 24,000, yes, the mayor has a point. You got to start somewhere. At the same time, you're going to have to ramp this up much, much faster.
And that's the $50 million bond, right? On the November ballot.
And remember the matching from the private sector.
So maybe $100 million.
If that comes through, because she's asked for $50 million from the private sector, $50 million from the faith community. That's $150 million. What kind of a dent, if all that money came in and they used it all relatively quickly to build these houses or help developers build these houses, what kind of a dent would it make?
That's a good question. I have not seen a number put on if they reach their target fundraising, how many housing units they would be able to build. And remember also, Mike, it takes a number of years just to build these projects. It's not like you just have the money and it's ready in 3 months.
Why are we here? We're here because there's no way for the city, other than things like this, to get developers to do this. And in recent years, they had some incentives, but you know, there was news reporting about how nobody was taking them up on the offer to do this. So they, go ahead.
I was going to say, I'm fighting the clock here, David. when she was on Charlotte Talks yesterday, I spoke with Mayor Lyles about the idea of being floated by some council members on to transition from 2-year to 4-year office terms. So I'm completely changing the subject here. But I brought up former city councilman and former Republican mayoral candidate Kenny Smith's op-ed piece in The Observer, in which he characterized this as one of the biggest power grabs in the history of our city. And here's how she responded.
Can I roll my eyes here a bit? I'm sorry.
But she does think the decision should wait.
We've got a big population count coming up. That will be done in 2020. We'll be looking at, are we equally represented by population? And then how should we decide the vote? So right now, I don't have the urgency that some of the council members have on this.
So this idea was floated by Braxton Winston. I think it's supported by Julie Eisel, the mayor pro tem, James Mitchell, and others. Have we heard reactions from anybody else on council about this?
Yes, I talked with James Mitchell actually about this to see, well, where's the reasoning behind this? And he's actually been pushing for this even before Braxton Winston for a while. And he says it's because with the 2-year model, they really only work for 18 months. And several council members have said this before, including the mayor, that you know, you work for a year, then you work for about 6 months, and then you're back on the campaign trail. I also talked with Tarek Bakari about this, one of the few Republicans on council. He says, as it stands alone, 4-year terms he does not support, but a compromise, maybe. So we'll see where that goes.
We'll talk some more about that when we come back. We'll talk about the bus drivers getting a raise and the Harris McCready race in the North Carolina 9th at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I'm Mike Collins. North Carolina voters will be deciding the course of state and national politics in the upcoming midterm. Join us for an election special Tuesday, October 23rd at 7 p.m. live from the Booth Playhouse in Founders Hall. More details at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. It's Charlotte Talks on the Local News Roundup on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. David Borax is here from WFAE News. Mary C. Curtis from Roll Call. Eric Spanberg is here from the Charlotte Business Journal. And Kirsten Garris from Spectrum News Charlotte. We were talking about the suggestion that city council go to 4-year, including the mayor, go to 4-year terms from 2-year terms, and they would be staggered with the at-large candidates running 2-year cycles away from the district candidates running, all up in the air. And some people, including former Mayor Roberts, who wrote a letter to the editor this week, says, okay, but it should go to a referendum of the people. The council shouldn't make this decision.
And council members, for the most part, the ones I've talked to agree. James Mitchell and Tarek Bakari, those are the two I've talked to directly. They agree this should go to the voters. This is not something that they should.
Bob Hageman, the city attorney, says they could do it.
They could legally. This is one of the few things. And that's what's interesting about this topic. And that's why I think it's generating so much conversation from past and present council members, is because this is the one thing they can do without approval from the General Assembly. And in a Dillon Rule state, there's very few things the city council can do on their own, especially changing their terms. And Bob Hageman also said they can not only change their terms, they could add a position I think they have to have is at least 3, but as many as 12 council seats, so they could take away at large, they could add some things. And this is where Tarek Bakari says he's willing to negotiate, so to speak, because if they could maybe take away an at-large seat and add another district seat, he might be able to get more Republicans on city council. So that's why he said he's open to it if there's a way we can, you know, again, find a compromise there.
I was going to say that. So what's interesting about this, Mike, a couple things. First of all, is that little negotiation, which no doubt is we're getting stomped in these elections. So let's pull back from the at-large council seats. That's one thing. The second thing is, yes, council can do this. There has to be some sentiment within the Democratic Party in particular of watch what you do and ask for, because while they can do that, then the General Assembly, as we've seen in other cities in North Carolina, can change the composition of city councils. So I would say those two things. And also remember, Mike, that in 2015, Mecklenburg County did put four-year terms on the ballot. Right. It went to the voters. 66% of them said no thanks.
Okay. Yeah.
And a future council could change it, too. That's the thing. Yeah. Just because it's written in stone for one term, right, it could be changed again.
This could be a fascinating
negotiation. They're afraid of that backlash.
Nothing is permanent. Yeah. There's also disagreement on council over okaying a $60,000 contract with a cleaning service that cleans I'm a little confused about this, whether they clean the buses and the trains or they actually just clean facilities at CATS, but they do this after hours, and there was contention about this because the company doesn't pay what the council has characterized as a livable wage. I asked the mayor about this yesterday because paying workers a livable wage is one of the key goals of the council, a top priority at least, and she said that the state mandates that they go with the lowest bid on these contracts. So, again, very few tools in their toolkit, and she knows that. But why if she knows that, why the disagreement on council? They must know it, too.
Well, because I think you hit it in the first part of your question, Mike, which is that letter to the community that was issued right after the Keith Scott shooting and protests was that there would be a concerted effort to have livable wages across the city. And you're right, there is that restriction in terms of city bidding. But on the other hand, Braxton Winston, who of course came to prominence from those protests, is very much dedicated to the idea of livable wage. So there was very little chance he was going to let this slip by without having a strong
opinion. On the one hand, he's making a point about this, and it's a very strong point. You know, these jobs don't pay what we might consider to be a living wage, which Braxton Winston said was about $17 an hour. I think these are
$11 to $12
And I think the other point that he was making, and I think he maybe even asked, you know, is there some way we could do this in-house so that we can pay them what we want? Because the city has no control over what a private contractor pays. Right. But they could pay them, well, now the city minimum is 15, right? So if they were city employees, we could do that.
They could open their own cleaning department.
Yeah, but and all of these issues are related. We were just talking about affordable housing.
Right.
So how do you, you know, so many people in Charlotte are working, but they just can't afford to live. And so, of course, they're going to bring up these issues every time we come around. Also, you know, if they keep saying the state legislature is not letting us do some of these things, maybe that will drive people to, as far as Democrats are concerned, to try to break that Republican supermajority.
And Mary, I think this also gets into the issue that they're hashing out right now yet again, which is vendors, minority and women-owned firms, and who the city does business with. Well, this is similar in a way of, okay, what kind of company are you dealing with? What are they paying? And they don't have the ability now, but maybe that's something they explore depending on which way the council's direction goes.
Yeah, and the person who brought this up, Braxton Winston, is a newer council member who said as soon as he got into office, he was ready to shake things up. I think his phrase is, you know, shake up the systems, because he's someone who isn't your average council member. He does work blue-collar jobs, so I think he's more in tune with these issues. And so even though it wasn't going to, you know, they couldn't kill the contract, he still brought up the conversation. And I think a lot of council members, I know Luana Mayfield and Ed Driggs also chimed in. He's bringing to light issues that before may not have been brought up because, again, it's, oh, well, state mandate. We had to do X, Y, and Z because of state mandate.
Okay, I want you all to put on your Ann Doss Helms T-shirts.
Okay. Hold on, get ready.
Because she's not here.
I have my glasses on, so I'm already, you guys can't see it, but.
Doesn't fit.
She's not here today, and we have some CMS things going on. Some students have been arriving late for school and coming home later in the afternoon because of a shortage of CMS bus drivers. We're pretty deep into the school year for this to be happening, and now CMS officials have said that the starting pay for drivers will go up. By how much?
It'll be $15. There right now, the current rate is about $13. $12.87 an hour. It'll go up to $15 an hour. And then for the more experienced drivers who've been there for a while, who already make $15 an hour, they'll go up 50 cents an hour. They'll get that pay boost.
Okay. So there are, I think, 67 vacancies, bus driver vacancies, even though they've hired 105 bus drivers since August. 94 of those bus drivers left for higher paying jobs.
That's not a good percentage, Mike.
No, it's not.
In case you're scoring at home.
Yeah.
And if they're raising the pay to $15 an hour, and Mary just mentioned that the living wage is $17, this is not the city now. This
right.
This is CMS. It's not even the county, I guess. Why aren't they? Because the bus companies that they're competing with are paying
CATS
$17 an hour.
Right.
They're competing with the city, ironically, because it's like CATS and other companies.
And really, I think a lot of this is circling back to there's all this tension. People can't afford, or else from the school's standpoint, they're being priced out. You know where this comes back. It comes back to tax policy and or fees, right? And so no one wants to say, guess what? We need to raise taxes or we need to raise fees because, Mike, it's always an election year. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, I just tell you that I just drove through Virginia 2 weeks ago. Every road I drove on was better than any road in North Carolina.
Better?
Much better.
Better. Were any of them toll roads?
No.
No?
Actually, no. I was on the Dulles Express Road by mistake. I had to pay. I was on it for approximately 500 feet and had to pay a dollar to get off of it.
Well, that's why they're so good.
We appreciate your visit.
I'm just telling you that that's. I know what Virginia taxes are like, and that's why the roads are good, because they're high taxes. So let's see here. The controversy over the appointment of Brett Kavanaugh to a seat on the Supreme Court has also filtered down to CMS, to a middle school, South Charlotte Middle School. Mm-hmm. How did this contemporary topic rear its ugly head there?
It appeared on one of those signs, you know, usually where they put school announcements like, school's closed today. Well, someone put bleep, Kavanaugh, started with an F and you can figure out the rest. Uh-huh. So I'll leave that there. But yeah, well, as soon as CMS was notified, they said they got it cleared off in an hour.
Okay.
But we'll leave it at that.
Not before it made it onto social media and everybody's been talking about it.
So. Exactly. So,
partisan divide, it's down to middle school.
Speaking of partisan divide, one of the closest races, most closely watched congressional races in the upcoming midterms is the North Carolina 9th Congressional District, although it's not getting a lot of national attention. If you watch these cable news stations, they're not talking about this race that much, but it's with Mark Harris, the Republican who defeated the incumbent Republican Congressman Robert Pittenger, and Democrat Dan McCready. They faced off on Wednesday night on WBTV in a debate. Anybody watch it?
Yes.
How'd they do?
I think it went by the book in a lot of ways. I mean, no one said anything that surprised me in the least. You know, it was Nancy Pelosi. And then
Mark Harris, not from the other
side. Right. On the other side, it was country over party, U.S. Marines. Yeah. I mean, they both stuck
building
their,
a business from scratch.
Right.
I think it is starting to get a lot of play because, you know, Democrats hope to flip the House. It's looking good. And if they can flip this particular district, because even though the redistricting and the gerrymandering has been deemed unconstitutional, they're going to keep it in place for this race. So if they can win this district, which went for Trump, and which is kind of goes from Charlotte and Union County and it twirls around, it will be a sign that I think it would be a blue wave. Also, Dan McCready is a veteran, and it's part of the group from Seth Moulton of Massachusetts that he's trying to get these veterans to run as Democrats.
Talked about those guys around the country.
Yes.
And also interesting that the New York Times poll comes out this week and shows Harris up by 5 points. And, of course, you had the Civitas poll earlier that showed a 4-point lead for McCready. So clearly it's very, very close.
And you had Karen Pence and Donald Trump Jr., some of these stars coming in. And I think Karen Pence in particular was there because she was with Women for Mark Harris, because he has been hit for some of his, you know, he's a former Baptist pastor, for his speeches and his sermons that have said, you know, women should be submissive, and he's been hit for that.
So if this is a toss-up at the moment, this race, it's pretty close, hard to call. If Democrats retake the House, they have to flip 24 seats, and the ninth has been seen as one of their best shots. So if it's a toss-up, what does this say about the Democrats' chances of flipping the House?
We'll see you on November 6th.
Yeah, maybe.
The thing is, voter turnout is key in any of these elections.
It's a toss-up, I think.
It depends on who shows up.
What I just said.
Well, voter turnout is key, and there are other states like Pennsylvania and California where they're hoping to flip some more.
So what impact has the Kavanaugh situation had on this?
Well, it's basically a lot of folks pundits, you can't say because, you know, it's so many days out and so much can happen in that. Initially, it was thought to gin up the Republican enthusiasm that had seemed to be dampened for the midterms. At the same time, they won. Brett Kavanaugh was there, and usually being happy isn't as much of an incentive as being really, really mad. But it's made it a little tougher for some of these senators who are Democratic incumbents running in races in states that Trump won by a lot.
And a lot of money is coming into
tons.
This. Through
tons,
June,
yes.
McCready had piled up $2.7 million compared to $930,000 for Harris. The Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee is spending $222,000 on ads against Harris. The Environmental Defense Fund is spending $900,000 to support McCready and other Democrats. The Patriot Majority, which sounds like a right-wing organ, but it's not, they put $639,000 into supporting McCready. Anybody know what Harris and his supporters are pumping into his campaign?
Well, didn't Harris just had about $1 million sent his way from a national fund?
I'm the Donald Trump Jr. appearance was a fundraiser. And you've seen the ads go back and forth on television.
So the candidates themselves see a clear choice between each other, as both mentioned at the end of Wednesday night's debate on WBTV. First Dan McCready, then Mark Harris.
I don't think there's anywhere in the country where there's more of a difference on the ballot than there is here in North Carolina's 9th District.
There's a direct opportunity to choose very different paths on November 6th.
You think the voters see it that way?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a pretty clear choice. I mean, we just went through, you know, we're tired of hearing the same talking points over and over. I'm sure voters are, too, because they see the commercials all the time. But you're not going to confuse these two men for one another. They clearly are different people with different philosophies of governing.
And Republicans also spoke up. I mean, that speaks volumes that Mark Harris defeated Robert Pittenger in the primary. So it means that Republicans are ready for a change, too.
Okay, so both of those men will be on this program Monday morning at 9 o'clock. We'll have both candidates in the 9th Congressional District.
You should mention Nancy Pelosi.
Who?
Oh, yeah.
Is she running?
No.
Who knew? Who knew? No. So Eric Reed, the new Panthers safety, took a knee before playing in his first game. He was the first to support his former teammate Colin Kaepernick in that practice. Here's what he told reporters.
I've always been considering what's best for the movement. I've always told myself when the time comes to stop kneeling, then I'll stop. That time has not come.
And Cam Newton is supporting him, so we'll see where this goes from here. Meanwhile, the reaction to Graham Gano's shocking. And for him, record-breaking, game-winning field goal with, how was it, 2 seconds left, 3 seconds left? It was like a shot heard round the world. Most of us watched the game on TV or heard it on the radio, where the reaction from the announcers was excited, but you haven't heard anything until you have heard the Spanish-language broadcast of that moment.
Le ha sobrado distancia, le van a servir. Tiene altura, tiene profundidad, va a llegar, va a llegar. ¡Ganó, lo ganó! 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 ¡Señor! ¡Ganó, lo ganó! ¡Ganó, lo ganó! ¡Ya se le voy a los pates! ¡Taca, taca, 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 taca! ¡Ya se le voy a los pates!
That's awesome.
I need this everywhere he goes. As soon as I walk into the room, cue me.
It's great.
How could you
I
not love
that?
I think it's
great.
Fabulous.
And on top of that, a little Spanish lesson here. Gano means he won or I won. So the irony that his last name is Gano and he won the game.
Well, I'm glad he's on the Panthers then.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Were the announcers making that connection? Is that why they kept repeating it?
Logo, I mean, so he was, I'm not the best at, I'm not the best at Spanish, but he was there insinuating that. So that is perfect. I mean, it's great.
And in case anybody missed it, he did repeat. Repeat it a couple times just so you
got exactly a few times. Again, anytime I walk into a room, I need to hear that just so I get ready.
It sounded like a soccer match.
It did.
That's how they get to.
They call it football over football, there, it works.
Football.
It was so good.
Football.
So good. Field goal.
Well, so, Kirsten Garris was the person with the Spanish lesson, and today is her last day, both here on the Roundup and on Spectrum News Charlotte, because you're going to work in Memphis TV. What station in Memphis?
Box 13 in Memphis. I'll still be covering city county politics, so that is not going away. And Charlotte has a very special place in my heart, so I'll definitely be back to visit. Maybe not during 2020, I don't know, but definitely we'll be back to visit.
Well, you best of luck to you. You're a great reporter and a better person. Unless you want me to switch it around and say, say you're a great a person and a better reporter.
You will be
They're
missed.
Both great. Yeah,
okay. You will be missed.
Greatly huge. Huge great.
You will be missed. Thank you. Kirsten Garris from Spectrum News, Mary C. Curtis from RollCall.com, WFAE's David Borax, and from the Charlotte Business Journal, Eric Spanberg. Thank you all for the hour. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.